Welcome, everybody. This is Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice, and I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author, with Ken Wilber, of Integral Life Practice. I created this series in order to serve the evolution of the leading edge of consciousness and culture with a deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can play a key role in helping human beings to rise to the challenges of our world at a time of crisis so that we can make as benign as possible a transition to a truly sustainable human presence on our planet. And I've held a series of about 50 at this point, profound and enlivening conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'm really happy to be joined by a lifelong friend, Samuel Bonder, to continue and deepen that discussion in a conversation we've entitled, How Do We Deal with Ego Today? The way this will work is I'll introduce Samuel and we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements and we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions. So we'll finish up in probably about 90 minutes. Samuel Bonder founded the International Waking Down in Mutuality Teaching and Community. He's the author of Healing the Spirit-Matter Split, Waking Down, and quite a few other books, including two novels, including Ultimaya 1.0, which has just recently gotten rave reviews. Samuel's a pioneer in the democratization of embodied awakening and accelerated personal and mutual evolution. Since 1992, he and with his wife Linda and other Waking Down in Mutuality teachers have helped thousands, well, hundreds of people stabilize divinely human unity consciousness and grow in integral expressions of their total potential. And at this point, Samuel and Linda now often use the acronym ROSE work, describing the essence of the accelerated evolutionary psycho-spiritual integration process they teach, the ROSE standing for Radical Organismic Sentient Emergence. Now, speaking personally, I want to say one of the things that I most appreciate about Samuel is the deep heart of care and real getting of the depth and uniqueness of the divinity, the divine humanity of other beings. That is, for me, the real jewel in his heart and in his transmission, and it really motivates and powers his work with people. The most advanced teachers of the work he founded, the Waking Down and Mutuality work, express a remarkable capacity for deep empathy and care, especially an authentic ability to see this divinely human being in others without being confused by their imperfect and messy and broken ordinariness. They are able to really embrace all of that. Now, I met Samuel almost 40 years ago when we were both very young men, just early on our paths, and our life paths have proceeded independently, but also together with a lot of mutual respect and affection. We've woven in and out of each other's lives for a long time in a deepening friendship. So it's a real delight to welcome you, Samuel, as my guest today.
Well, thank you, Terry. Thanks for that very kind and generous introduction. And yeah, it's my total pleasure to be with you. It's been a long journey, and it's great that we keep weaving together.
Yeah, really. You know, it would seem, you know, many people on this line may have some familiarity with your work, but I'm sure there are quite a few who maybe never encountered you before. And it might be nice if you could offer a short, essential summary of the core of what it is you offer in your teaching work.
Yeah, sure. Waking Down in Mutuality is the somewhat longish title for it, but it's very descriptive. the waking aspect has to do with the transmission of and activation of the awakening process in people that leads to, fairly directly and rapidly in most cases, leads to a profound, stable non-separateness or unity consciousness, as you were saying there. And one, however, which getting ahead into the our conversation a little bit, I want to acknowledge, it's one in which you could say ego is included and transcended both. And the inclusion aspect is part of what makes our approach somewhat different from many other orientations available. But it's a live wire process. The transmission aspect of the work is very central. So the transformation that goes on is in effect one in which this conscious awakening and integration, which includes the down aspects of deep embodiment and also an ongoing revelation and integration of shadow material, clarification and refinement, we could say, of one's relationship to what has previously been hidden. And the mutuality aspect brings the magic of relating with others into play, both in terms of, we have a phrase we use, green lighting, in terms of being able to say yes to all of your parts, high and low, bright and dark, and to be able to do that with others. And there's something about, there's an energizing of the self plus other field, we could say, that we are all naturally living in this interconnectedness that's true of all of us. And so the whole waking down and mutuality process, as I was saying, is activated fundamentally by the transmission that primarily is imparted by authorized teachers, but more and more is active, alive, and among community members, many of whom have gone through this fundamental awakening themselves. And the way it functions is not merely, it's more nuanced and paradoxical than just like an energy that comes from one person and goes to another. It's more as if, except I would say it's bio-spiritually literally so, that the divine essence, the spark of life and consciousness that's actually beating the heart of every single one of our bodies and minds, begins to become self-aware by the impact or the influence of this transmission, energetic and consciousness. And so the process tends to therefore include all of these different aspects, and the teachers are, as you were indicating, they're trained to provide a very caring approach. Linda likes to say it's not a cookie cutter process, so we're looking to mutually not only give our transmission, but receive who the other person is, both verbally and also energetically and in their presence. And there's a deep listening that goes on in both directions. And so a lot of what makes the process so effective is that it's not engaged in the abstract, and it's not something you superimpose on yourself as a system to be adapted to like everybody else does, but rather each participant is welcome to go deeply into just exactly what makes him or her tick and share that, bring all the pieces forward, including, quote-unquote, your story or your egoic difficulties and stresses. And the deep acceptance of all of that is in the context of the community container and this transmission field, which is a very important point. That's the framework within which the deeper acceptance of and also transcendence of ego is made possible. All of that tends to work very fruitfully for people who get seriously interested. So is that a good start?
Yeah, that's a great start. I think people have a little bit of a feeling then for the real, you know, textures of what it's like to work with you, and that's terrific.
Good.
And it's a natural segue, I think, into the stated topic that we're trying to dive into, which is how do we deal with ego today? How do we best deal with ego today? And I know in our previous conversations, you've paid some attention to the various definitions of that very sticky word. Would you like to kind of just launch into maybe an orienting summary as to how you approach that? Because obviously there are very strong arguments that are almost indisputable on both sides of this question. The one being that ego is what constantly gets in the way, and unless we can transcend ego, we can't get anywhere. And ego is always, you know, just look at at politics, look at our economy. It's selfish, egoic behavior that's in the way of everything. It subverts the spiritual way. It creates spiritual materialism. We've got to get ego out of the way. Ego is the problem. And on the other side, people say, without a healthy ego, you're nowhere, Jack. Nothing's happening in your life, in your heart. And it's only on the foundation of a strong and healthy ego that any kind of higher spiritual consciousness is possible. This negative relationship to ego is just undermining the whole conversation. With that as our context, you seem to have stepped in with maybe some pretty nuanced views that go much deeper than that simple dichotomy of that split between those two, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
Views.
I would say there's something at least a little closer to a both and. That's our most optimal orientation, at least over time as we all take all this forward. Yeah, to me, the part of the difficulty here, I think, is what do we mean by that word? The word ego, particularly nowadays, and over the last several decades, it's been growing. In spiritual circles of various kinds, the word ego is reaching the pinnacle of misunderstanding and projections on its meanings, comparable to words like God, love, and enlightenment. You know, what are we exactly talking about here? And when we say that you've got to have an ego to be a sane, healthy human being, we're really talking about ego as, in the simplest sense, the psychic, self-aware organizing principle of a basically mature human organism or human being. And so that sense of I or me, whether you feel intensely separate and cut off from the rest of the world and distressed or not, you know, you can, your ego sense can be present and you can feel very connected and in communion and even in profound realization of the more transcendental dimension of identity. But that basic organizing principle is alive and cooking. And I remember once, I think I told you this story, I had a conversation with a guy who was a disciple of a very powerful, controversial, colorful Buddhist teacher. And of course, you and I both were with a very powerful, colorful, controversial, non-aligned to any particular tradition teacher. And this guy and I had just met, and we were trying to, I think we were sort of dancing around how to talk about our teachers and really be honest with each other. And he really broke the ice. He said, you know, don't you think it's curious that these amazing characters who propose to be completely egoless, really, they're like the biggest egomaniacs on the planet. And, I mean, he was exaggerating to some degree, but we both cracked up laughing. And, you know, it's an interesting point. In other words, the identity of a local self that is different from all the other local selves was very prominent in those teachers and is in many people who otherwise propose to be enlightened or awake. So to me, the distinction here then is ego in some of the other possible definitions, which would include complete kind of self-enclosure, self-absorption, selfishness, an incapacity to empathize with and take the point of view of another, a chronic manipulation of events, circumstances, and people toward one's own ends, and an obvious kind of, by other people's standards, a very deprived value system where everything's all about me, the individual ego person, separate from everyone and everything else. And there are, you know, all kinds of versions of definitions that we could get into, but that quality of ego clearly is something that certainly we're looking to help people outgrow. And I think all authentic spiritual and religious life is trending in that direction.
You know, one of the topics I want to get in with you more richly while we have this hour together is Adi Da. And I know a lot of people are fascinated with him negatively and positively. And as two of the people who are independent teachers who come from that sometimes highly respected and sometimes, sometimes we're, there are those who dismiss both of us simply because we have him as our root guru. it's a controversial credential. I think it'd be rich for us to talk about him in more depth. But because he is so controversial, because he tends to take up more space than we ever intend, and so I want to kind of hold that off a little longer to get into this discussion of ego a little more fully.
Okay.
Although I definitely think it's exciting to get together with you and get into that, so it's by no means to just to put it off a little longer, not to neglect it. So to me, the thing that I seem to hear and feel in your way of working with ego that's different is this. We're living in a postmodern moment in relation to spirituality altogether. And there was a traditional era that Adi Da is in some ways one of the culminating, he's an incredibly rich and comprehensive expression of all the kinds of spirituality that preceded him. And that spirituality is expressed in a path that involves the breaking of the fixations of attention in the gross level of the mental levels of the mind, this kind of superficial so-called ego, and releases it into vaster domains of subtlety that become more and more sublimed and opened, and superconscious knowledge and non-ordinary powers and all kinds of things can accrete. And then even all that can be transcended in turning to the very root of attention, in which consciousness itself is recognized to be the non-separate identity of all arising phenomena. And one can plunge into that root with incredible power and depth, and then come free of even the exclusive identification with that root consciousness, into a non-separate condition in which consciousness is non-separate from all phenomena, and one is the dance of the arising non-separate, and the potency of that incredible awakened transmission permeates experience, and one is a blessing force. But the purification of the body-mind, the disciplining of attention, the perfection of the vehicle are all structurally necessary to that version of the path. And the fulfillment of that path takes decades, and only a few in each generation fulfill it perfectly. And there's been a large and general awareness in our generation, and we're really among the first teachers who are teaching in a new territory in which many, many have said, that's a wonderful thing, and that great path is valuable, and there are things that can only be reached through the fulfillment of all of its richness, but we can live on the basis of the implications of the most radical realization right from the beginning, and that's the most important part. And we have people like Andrew Cohen or Craig Hamilton who are saying, recognize that and live beyond anything less and transcend ego. And we have, I think, in your teaching something that stands on the other side of that and says, yes, live on the basis of that and recognize that nothing is not God, nothing is not deserving of love, and even those parts of yourself that you have disowned are no less God. And there's a kind of loving and even a love in oneself for the broken off or otherwise rejected or broken dimensions of the being, such that that self-disowning and splitting of the psyche into the acceptable and non-acceptable, divine and undivine portions is blown away. And you're really intending to be a stand for that onlyness in a different way. And I always feel that this is not always recognized, that you're taking a kind of radical stand that is, even in the structure of the larger conversation, quite interesting, and I don't really see it expressed with the same fullness by anyone else. And I'd really like to give a chance for that to come forward really fully.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I think you've very well summarized some good distinctions there. I mean, that was pretty brilliant, Terry. Thank you. And very, you know, accurately appreciative of what we're doing and the kind of stand that we find ourselves taking. And happily, I'm in a position to, I'm not using the word we in the royal or rhetorical sense. Luckily, I've been able to communicate this in such a way that quite a number of people have become equally profound and articulate in their own ways in both transmitting and espousing this orientation. And yeah, I would say that our approach is one in which there is first of all a recognition, as Linda likes to say, she's got this phrase that the world is largely populated by hungry, hurting hearts. In our sense of separateness from the divine, from source, from ultimate reality, from happiness, fundamental wellness, you know, all of those qualities, we're impoverished. And so from our perspective, there is a preliminary infusion, that this transmission that we talk about and practice sharing with people functions as a kind of primal nutrition. At a deep cellular level, as well as of the whole psychic structure, and the, of course, the spiritual essence of our nature. And you quoted that acronym Linda and I have been using, ROSE, Radical Organismic Sentient Emergence. So what happens is that from its radical heart source or core, where it's bio-spiritually literal, it's not just a metaphor that some kind of remarkable principle is animating these bodies, sourcing the heartbeat, and appears to be, in the traditions that you and I both have come from, Adi Da, and I previously was really more my root guru was Sri Ramana Maharshi of India, and there's a focus on a place in the heart, literally the heart organ, that appears to be the ultimate seat of consciousness and the ultimate location, so to speak, of realization. Given that the realization is of a boundlessness, it's very paradoxical to speak in those terms. But this transmission is enlivening the hearts of others in such a way that we could say, going into the equally risky territory of, you know, masculine-feminine typology, there's a deep feminine beginning to the whole process of awakening and ego transcendence in our approach that has to do with this primal nutrition being received and coming alive and awake, being metabolized in each one's whole being or organismic life. And what that leads to then is, among other things, one important way to clarify here is that as you do awaken and integrate all of these different parts, and from our perspective, you do gain a stable, undeniable, it's just the everyday given of existence, access to that ultimate transcendence and inclusion, that suchness of conscious embodiment that fundamentally knows no difference. As that takes place, there's a recognition that previously we were operating on the basis of a split between spirit and matter, between unconditioned consciousness and all conditional and changing phenomena. And so that split is healed. And more, our perception then becomes one in which it's seen that instead of that great cycle of kind of trying to get out of ego and going through the various subtle and causal dimensions and finally getting to the ultimate non-dual in and of itself, and then that becoming known to be one with everything and non-different, there is a simultaneous enlivenment and awakening of the whole structure. And it has the, in effect, people start to realize my picture was kind of wrong. My life wasn't really about getting out of this kind of horrible, cut-off, ungodly, earthly, egoic existence and, you know, achieving liberation, for instance, from the wheel of birth and death, classic traditional language. It's more as if I, as a divinely human being, am coming in for a landing into this, as you were saying, truly divine world in which nothing is less godly than anything else, and at the same time, there certainly are all kinds of criteria and distinctions that are important for our optimal living in the relative world together. So that deep feminine work is a beginning, and we then find, sure enough, it's as if that non-dual or ultimate non-separate radical unity was like just waiting to get a toehold in anybody's particular body-mind. And then later, there is a progressive purification, refinement, growth, evolutionary transformation, a movement toward more and more of capacity to be in service to and blessing the whole world and others, having one's purpose shine forth more and more clearly, and, you know, finding great calling and dedication to it. So we're looking to get to somewhat of a similar place, but it's a different approach. Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I think is going to be most interesting for you to link up, particularly on this Beyond Awakening series, is to, it's been my observation that during a certain period of time of doing this waking down work, you create an incubator, a protected space in which individuals can dwell in an environment in which they really end the war with the disowned and rejected and so-called non-divine parts of themselves. And they come into the company of other people who are practicing a different orientation in which their divine humanity gets a chance to be seen and affirmed and validated and mirrored back to them. And during that period of time, they really need to be in an environment with, that's pretty much free of messages that they should be this or should do that or should practice this in order to become anything they aren't already. And that in that period of time, it's like a kind of radical fast of injunctions. And therefore, there's a certain period of time when people are involved in your work where there's not a lot of orientation to the larger imperatives of our world and our time. It doesn't look like a very activist path. It looks more like a moment in therapy where someone is really deeply engaged with their own process. But in our conversations, you've talked with me about how that process becomes full and then in a natural upwelling of one's essential being, a desire and a destiny to be of service and to be participating in a way that is more potentially activist or evolutionary is the natural expression of the work. And I think linking those up for people would be a really rich addition to the public communication about what your work involves, and maybe even speaking in a way that calls forth your version of and your personal sense of the calling for that you are responding to and that other people awakening in your tradition might be called to, because I think it's important for that call to be visible and seen.
Yeah, thank you. Well, this is something that you and I, from just about the day we met in ancient times, we recognize that, both of us essentially came out of the late 60s into the early 70s with a profound revolutionary spirit, a tremendous desire to change everything, and a recognition that it had to happen. And everything that's happened in the last 40 years or thereabouts, one of the things we're certainly in agreement on is that the evidence remains all the more stark that humanity as a whole somehow has to go through a great change. So that's how I came into my work, was with the recognition that unless the essence of the change at heart was deeper than a cosmetic kind of revolutionizing of the next batch of separate egos trying to run things and make it all work. Unless something profoundly deeper comes into play, we're not going to be able to avert the increasingly ominous crises that are in front of us and all over us right now. We're no longer ahead in time. So that being said, yeah, as I got into my work, my orientation has always had this kind of, you could say, an activist fervor at the core, but not everybody is that way, which, of course, is something I discovered as I began teaching. And then, however, at a deeper level, exactly what you're pointing out is what we've discovered, that when someone gravitates into this kind of process, that period of, we could say, a deep feminine self-acceptance or green lighting, being with, really does require the individual for at least a period of time, like you said, not to have to worry about the shoulds. You should do this, you should do that, here's the practice, da 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 da. Nothing of the sort is really useful. And at a deeper level also, what's happening is the beginning of a transformation that empowers that person with their own autonomous, we would say divinely human agency or capacity to take action for the greater good. And as you know, one of the wonderful gifts that I've gotten from my involvement with the integral work of Ken Wilber and the integral community in general is a kind of adaptation of the developmental theorist James Fowler is what he calls stages of faith, and I transmute that a little bit and call them ages of trust. The pertinent ones are beyond the conventional stages of learning and believing and belonging and conforming to something outside yourself, into first a deep individualization or individuation, and then an equally deep capacity to unite and hold apparently opposing parts of yourself and the world. And in some ways, what happens in Waking Down and Mutuality is first those two stages, deep individuation questioning, in which you're learning to stand autonomously in yourself, initially allowing this infusing transmission to bring you alive and awake in new ways from the core, from the radical source of your being, and then being able to, you know, as you so aptly put it, see the worst parts of yourself and love them and get into them, allow them to show themselves, to reveal them, their nature to you from the inside, rather than holding them off at a distance and trying and trying and trying to transcend them. And so what we've seen is a kind of a period. You know, I started the work formally in mid-93, informally began after my awakening in late 92. So, you know, we're approaching two decades now. And what we're seeing is really a natural, we could say, organismic evolutionary process for the collective culture of the work, in which about 5 or 6 years ago, numbers of us who were in the leadership began saying, okay, folks, we've gotten really good at this deep feminine holding and being with, but as Fowler points out and the other developmentalists, any stopping at any stage isn't just stasis. It involves a kind of a toxic stagnation that it's definitely not growth. And so we began calling one another and to begin to infuse into the culture more of, we could say, that masculine agency, more of a call to service. When I started my work, as you know, I had so many people coming who had been burned out, pulverized by being with teachers, traditions, communities, schools, experiments that had essentially taken everything they would give and left them feeling kind of bewildered and burned out and emptied. And so we had to make a lot of room for people not to have to do anything that, you know, wasn't obviously what they were moved to do. At this stage, that's really in a process of transition. And culturally, I think in the next 3 to 5 years, that perception of our work will have changed quite a bit. I know from the kind of conversations I'm having with people, more and more people are recognizing I've got to move on to, in Fowler's language, he calls it universalizing. He uses examples like Gandhi and Martin Luther King. But any everyday person in their ordinary life can move from, in effect, the kind of more adolescent stage of finding out who I am again in and of myself, and into a deeper adult nuanced life of being able to see and perceive others and hold all these different qualities in myself and others, and beyond even that to a life of serving and blessing, a life that we could say is calling-driven or purpose-driven, to use Rick Warren's phrase. Mission-maddened is how it sometimes feels for people. And it's really one that goes way beyond, in effect, a kind of loving, caring, but still navel-gazing, or, you know, in oneself and together. And, you know, the final thing I'll just mention about this briefly is with real developmental growth, you can't, there's great danger in trying to leap ahead. It's like, you know, you telling your son when he was 12, you know, be 20 now. You got to go all the way through it. So I think we're in a to me, very exciting stage of transition with that.
Beautiful. Well, we could go much further into this. Maybe we should, but we've promised to talk a little about Adidas and, in a way, kind of hang out in, you know, in some sense, you and I are, you know, let me just speak personally. You'll say it your way. You know, I think we witnessed a jaw-dropping miracle of the first order and have been irrevocably changed by that miracle. And are, you know, for myself, I'm rendered, you know, eternally grateful. What I got from Adidas, what Adidas still is in my consciousness is, you know, in that sense, I'm still a devotee, just utterly in the mode of gratitude. And I had to fight for my life with him, and only through the most profound kind of struggle have I been able to be who I am. And I feel tremendous resonance and large-scale agreement with almost every point of view that is surfaced about him, even though they are so in conflict with one another. I think that his worst critics and his most eloquent devotees are all speaking to real truths.
Yeah.
And what it is to stand as an inheritor of that complex blessing and empowerment is, it's really a riddle. Because in some quarters, when I speak positively about him particularly, but even just hearing that I was with him, people begin to, you know, they marginalize, they take me as someone who cannot see through grandiosity, narcissism, preciousness, delusion, all kinds of things that seem prima facie to be what he's all about. And there's very little openness to me. And I know you're dealing with the same dynamics. I think it's interesting for us to talk about what it is to be working with that legacy, but also what it is to be rightly related to the incredible gifts we were given.
Yeah, well, thank you. I feel quite similarly. My work would not be possible without, not even remotely, without what I received from Adidas. And at the same time, like you, I had to get up and walk out the door under the explicit threat of hellish karmas for lifetimes for breaking the vows that he had required all of his devotees to take in relation to him as eternal guru, et cetera, et cetera. It's been a long process of achieving a more and more simple and evident psycho-spiritual autonomy. Looking back, I mean, it's a little bit like my relation to my biological father, who died, as you know, just midsummer last year. Happily, we got to a place where, you know, we were both obviously ourselves and could deeply appreciate one another, and I could see his tremendous strengths and gifts to me, and also the ways in which he was, sure enough, a very limited human being. And it's similar with Adidas, and I agree with you. I think there are certain aspects of his communication, his realization of divine and total reality as quote-unquote the heart with a capital H, the nature of his transmission work, his blessing work. There are certain aspects of his gifts, his what he called the bhava or divine outshining, certain aspects of his contribution to humanity that, from my perspective, we're going to have to take note of individually and more and more collectively. He's not going to go away, and he can't be reduced to as opposite extremes, which also, however, we run grave danger just glossing them over and arbitrarily assigning perfect divinity to all that as if it wasn't an aspect of the total reality of existence that he might well have transcended were it possible for him. So, yeah, he's an incredibly complex character, and I definitely agree with you. Both extremes of his nature and everything in between have to be squared up to, and you've got to become pretty strong in yourself to be able to do that, pretty strong in yourself and pretty receptive to wildly paradoxical possibility.
Well, what would you, somehow I feel like he's still remaining a little abstract in this conversation, and I think the good thing we can do maybe is to bring him to life a little bit more.
Uh-huh.
People see these pictures of him, and he seems like this, either people have fallen in love with him, and they're his devotees, and he seems like the very embodiment of divine blessing and fragrance, and they're feeling in love, or they look at him and he just seems incredibly narcissistic and precious and preposterous, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing is almost garishly absurd. You know, there's this revulsion that a lot of people feel to him just in the abstract. And I find it very difficult to enter into conversations. You know, he makes the assertion that he is not a human being in any
mm-hmm.
ordinary sense, that our way of framing him, our frames of reference for evaluating him are all entirely inappropriate because in his radical transcendence of egoity, he is the presence of the me of God, and he speaks in that. You know, I would say his archetype is the Jehovah archetype. I mean, he is
mm-hmm.
this incredibly thunderous, potent, and see, and what people who haven't encountered him don't really have a way of accounting for is the incredible spiritual fragrance that
mm-hmm.
was. I mean, there was such potent transmission of tenderness and love and radiance in his company just about 24/7 for all the years I knew him, that so shifted the context of all his preposterous behaviors that having a conversation with, it was tricky, because having a conversation with other people who saw and felt that was bound by that in another way. But then trying to have a conversation
right.
with someone who doesn't have any experience of that tends to miss something. And
no, misses something huge.
And, you know, on the one hand, it's like you can say nothing critical. And I felt it was very important to take third-person perspectives on the whole dynamic and to see the meta-dynamics
mm-hmm.
of... And I think that it was absolutely critical for both of us. I'm so glad I left. I'm so glad that I did not... I had to try to serve in a way that broke out of the isolation, the insular, I mean, insularity, right? He lived on an island, and culturally his work is confined in an noetic island all by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the blessing that he helped empower and, you know, through my combining of myself with him, I became on fire with something that needs to find its way into the world as much as possible. And this insularity is an absolute obstruction to it. And even when he made us his first editors, actually folks may not know this, but he had always written all his own stuff. He never really had given up that. Even though Nina and others had helped him, there was a kind of moment when he said, it's time for me to have my own editors, and he asked you and then me to be his first editors. And in that, he asked us to, you know, make satsang available. And it was not really just taking on a Guru Seva job in an ashram. It was almost a transmission initiation moment that I remain faithful to. I'm faithful to it in a non-cultic way, and I think
mm-hmm.
you may feel the same, that you remain faithful to it in a non-cultic way as well. And it seems to me, in fact, that whatever was best and most necessary in what he gave can only be brought forward in a way that isn't inside this guru cult that he left behind. Not that I actually have a lot of respect for the folks who are still his devotees, and I feel like they're performing a wonderful service, but they're certainly not doing much to communicate his work very broadly in the world. And it seems that it needs to find its way forward in a way that allows a left-hand path, a path for people who are not willing to go into a monological locking in on him as the divine only and not taking any kind of critical perspectives. That's just not available in this integral age, that people need a freer and much more potentially adolescent, critical, defiant frame, and still to become appreciative of what I think are still some really important and incredibly potent dimensions of his transmission that I want to see more and more people turn on to. I actually am an advocate for people reading and partaking of his transmission because I think there's something unique in it. How do you feel about all that?
Well, yeah, there's a lot there. Just a couple of little things to clarify. You mentioned Nina. That's Nina Davis, who is a woman who was his first wife and a fellow editor to us when we were working. And I feel very similarly. And one way I would put it is to echo what you were saying, it's impossible to make sense of this being if you have no sense whatsoever of the extraordinary radiant love, the tenderness, the intimacy of the heart of being with him that was so instantly communicated, once there is a certain receptivity that people had. And for me, it's part of the, in some ways, to date kind of tragedy of the emergent evolutionary spiritual movement, that the specifics of his transmission, his realization and transmission, including what Michael Murphy referred to a long time ago as the perennial anatomy, the contributions about the anatomy of our most essential being, until those are taken into account more fully, humanity is just not relating to something that is a great gift to all of us, requiring us, as you say, to do our own work, to stand in autonomous discernment in relation to it, but also benefiting from its gifts. And from my perspective, that's really crucial. And, you know, you're talking about the early work that we did. And for me, there was a great moment when we finished that first book, the only book we worked on together, and it was the third book published in his whole work after his autobiography, The Knee of Listening, and then his book of very powerful initial teaching talks, The Method of the Siddhas. And we produced this book called Garbage and the Goddess. And I had come to Adi Da having gone through an initiation of this radical divine core of the heart through Ramana Maharshi, who, as I say, is, you know, to me, my root guru, because that was when it was through Ramana's teaching and presence and taking up the meditation, the self-inquiry that he taught, that there was a spontaneous awakening of this fire of living being in my heart of hearts that was totally unanticipated by me and was not in the heart chakra. It was in a different place in the heart. And then when I realized, you know, Ramana had died years before I was born, so I knew I needed a teacher. I didn't know where to go with this further. And I read Franklin Jones, then Bubba Frijon, when we were first getting to know him. And he was saying, I am that heart. I know this with perfect certainty. I'm living it very different in the world than Ramana. But he regarded Ramana as his spiritual father, in a sense. At least early on, his relation to all that changed. Well, when you and I and our friend, a woman named Marie, who was helping us put the book together, sat with him as he read through the manuscript that morning, and then we all left, the room, and we'd been up several nights in a row, so we were all woozy, and he was just, I think, humoring us, having us there, but also, you know, sitting at his table in his little house there up in Northern California here, and he was reading through the manuscript, and we just sat in his presence, his darshan, and kind of swooned there for hours. And as we walked out the door, he gave each of us a hug. And that hug, for me, was one of the great moments of my time with him. Because that same, in my language, white-hot core essence of living spirit just leaped right out of his heart and right into mine. And I knew I was with someone who indeed was living that same heart. Well, to me, the point here is that there's a treasure trove of gift that he represents. And if you don't understand his teaching from the point of view of that unique disposition on perennial anatomy and the advances that he made about that, you also, in my view, can't really understand how he could have possibly gotten to what otherwise seemed to be these, quote unquote, you said, well said, preposterous assertions. I'm the only one who's ever lived this. I am the one everyone has been waiting for. Even Krishna, the allegory of Krishna, is a premonition of me. You know, where does somebody who is actually sane come off saying such things? Well, you know, there's a trackable evolution in that man's history that makes it all make sense. Because he wasn't saying that from the beginning. And there was a growth, and there were limitations in the way he lived. The insularity was something that he always instinctively chose rather than be a true part and a participating player in a larger dialogue. He was convinced in that sense, even from early on, that he was, I think, too special to be ever seen and appreciated fully by others. So, you know, there's a lot to it, but, you know, people who write him and then his quote-unquote progeny like us just write us off out of hand, I think may truly be depriving themselves and our world of something that can be integrated, needs to be, and when it is done so, can be a great gift, a great furtherance.
You know, I want to kind of move on from this dominant topic here in just a moment. If you don't mind, I'll offer the two things I've found myself able to say that I felt were the most effective some things were to say. First, that Adi Da was two parts Jesus Christ, one part Picasso, one part Nagarjuna, one part Marlon Brando, and one part Genghis Khan, and more. And somehow that captures a little something of his unique nature for me. And then the other thing I say that I think is even maybe more to the point is that any time anyone really dares to kind of make any kind of ontic statement about him, that he is this or that, and pretends in any way to understand him or convey him, they're nominating themselves to be one of the blind men groping the elephant and declaring something about its nature, because he really does tend to exceed all the points of view that we throw at him. He's quite something.
Yeah, well, you know, I totally agree. I love those descriptions, and I'll add a couple of real quick ones. To me, he was a... in the final analysis, a hyper-masculine flamethrower and a Moses who could not enter his own promised land. Hyper-masculine in the sense that in the final analysis, he still maintained the radical division between ultimate reality and manifesting phenomena with an implicit and explicit degrading of manifest phenomena that perpetuates a deep split in everyone's heart, a deep doubt of our full existence. And he wasn't able to, you know, that great inquiry question of his, avoiding relationship. It wasn't given to him to meet others as any kind of equal in relatedness. And so he wasn't able to enter the promised land of mutuality that and deep radical interconnectedness with all of our full divinity potentially manifesting more and more fully, that now, you know, grateful to all our forebears, you and I and so many others are moving forward to chart out new premises and approaches to manifesting more fully together.
Beautiful. Well, we could go on forever on all these topics, and I'm sure in private conversations we'll go a lot further in the time ahead. But I know that a lot of the folks listening online have questions for you, and I have a few important announcements. So if you have a question for Saniel or for me, please type it into the instant teleseminar window on your computer, or if you've dialed in by telephone, you can raise your hand by pressing *2 on your keypad. That'll raise your hand and we'll know you'd like to speak up. For those of you who like what you've heard this morning and you'd like to learn more about Saniel and Linda, and he works together with his wife Linda Groves Bonder, who's a remarkable teacher in her own right, and you want to learn more about that and about waking down in mutuality and how to realize a heart-awakened life without having to master your mind and ego first, go to heartgazing.com, heartgazing.com. And you can register there to download Saniel and Linda's free 4-hour online course, Transmission of the Heart, and get on their mailing list for telecourses and live events and their communications of uncommon wisdom. If you're interested in my work, I will be offering a weekend seminar, Encountering the Beloved, in New York City, March 3rd and 4th. I will also be offering a 5-day deep experiential seminar on integral leadership at Hollyhock Farm in British Columbia, Canada, June 10th through 15th. And you'll be able to find out more details and also obtain my free ebook, The Seeker's Dilemma, by going to integralspiritualpractice.com, or you can get there by typing integralheart.com also. You can also look for an email that we'll be sending you early this coming week with more information about all those things. And also, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. I have a lot to tell you about first up, but I want to mention our next dialogue, particularly now. In 2 weeks, I'll be speaking on the topic, Only Higher Consciousness Can Transform Our World, with physicist and spiritual activist John Hagelin. Now, you may be aware of him. He has helped direct some of the most important research into the powerful nonlinear effects of meditation and unity consciousness and the non-dual implications of leading-edge physics. And he was the Natural Law Party candidate for President of the United States in 1996 and 2000, quite significantly in 2000. Also, in February, I will be bringing you James Baraz, the Dharma and meditation teacher and author of Awakening Joy. And then we'll open up the phone lines at the end so we can hear at least some of each other's voices as we say goodbye. Okay, let's take a look and see if we have some questions. Yes. Well, you've got some. Let's start off with a question from the furthest away question from Kanyakumari, India. Sarachandra Raj asks, "Is the very concept of me, if the very concept of me is an ego creation, who is actually experiencing the ego or something else beyond ego?"
How did that question begin? If what?
If the very concept of ego is, I you know, it disappears after I finish with it, so I can't read it to you again.
Okay.
Word for word. But it's basically saying if if, in a sense, ego is illusion, who is it that's experiencing ego?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, gosh, I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name either precisely, but I think...
Raj, I think.
Raj, okay. Raj, respectfully, I would question the if, for starters, because to me, the way you frame the question is more or less proposing that ego is illusion, and the you know, the only true answer could be only the ultimate reality that is inherently impersonal and ego-free could be having this illusory experience of ego. And to me, my orientation is different. To me, the experience of ego, yes, is taking place in the same, we could say, the great spectrum of identity that also includes the transcendental or impersonal ground and ultimate unity of being, of self, of existence. But it is, it has its own natural realness. It's as real and divine and important as that greater ground of reality. So it's not merely that the transcendent true self is having an experience of an illusory ego. To me, it's all a great divinely human reality and identity.
Mm. You know, that edges up against some other questions that we got.
Okay.
Let me offer two more, because in a sense it's just invitations to expand on what you're saying right now.
Okay.
Alberto Roman from Atlanta asks, what is ego? Are you talking about the Freudian ego, the Jungian, the Lacanian? There are so many interpretations both to the value and obstacle that the construct ego entails. How is ego used in a transformational context? And then Sidney McGill from Jamaica, Wisconsin asks, anger and fear are two emotions that I use to easily detect some actions of my ego. Should I continue modulating these emotions as a way of keeping my ego in check?
Hmm. What was his name? Sidney?
Sidney, yeah.
Sidney, okay.
Alberto.
Sidney. Yeah, you know, great questions, and I agree. I mean, that was how we started out. I was basically saying, when we use the word ego, what the hell are we talking about? And there are so many nuances and also widely diverging viewpoints that are possible. So, you know, to me, when I'm using the word ego in working with people, I'm typically talking fundamentally to, in practical terms, that sense of an individual I that is separate from, or maybe better to say, at least distinct from other I's or senses of me, and is identified with the local, ordinarily appearing body-mind persona here in the waking state, whatever experiences one may have in dreams and other conditions. And in the transformational context, then, our approach to it and our work is, as my friend Krishna Gauchi, who's a senior teacher of Waking Down and Mutuality, has an essay called The Central Place of Ego in Waking Down and Mutuality, and he makes a well-reasoned and well-informed case for the orientation to not merely kind of, in a friendly way, tolerate that local personal self sense, but to fully green light it in the context of this transmission of a transcendentally inclusive condition of existence and a community that has a value system that isn't merely getting stuck on telling people there, your ego is just fine as it is. And that then goes to Sidney's question. Yes, indeedy. You know, I totally support, you know, we don't, to the green lighting or acceptance is not an indiscriminate, uninformed, and undiscerning self-indulgence, in most of our lives, most of our relational conditions, it's absolutely necessary to restrain our acting out of, you know, forceful hot zone emotions and reactions like anger and fear. But in the context of a culture of people who are initiated into a profoundly emergent transformative dynamic, such as what we do in Waking Down and Mutuality, there are places and times and relationships where Linda has this beautiful teaching called six-step recognition yoga with respect to things like anger and fear. See it, feel it, live it, be it. In other words, go all the way into it, know it from the inside out, speak it at appropriate moments along the way, and then a transcendence in place begins to emerge where you more and more are knowing the ultimate freedom and essential radiance of being right in the midst of and paradoxically simultaneous with any such quality that emerges or arises. And gradually you are less and less governed by your previous reactions to it.
Beautiful. Well, let's plunge ahead. We have more questions. And I think I'd like to hear from a live caller. So we have someone with a 727 area code. I can't tell your name. Please introduce yourself. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Robin.
Hi, Robin. Welcome.
Hey, Robin.
It's my pleasure to be on the call with you today. I was really interested in your discussion about Adi Da, and I've had a rather rare life experience myself that I'm having a lot of difficulty integrating into my own life, and met someone who is very comparable to what you've described about him. And it was in Santa Fe, and of course we all know that Santa Fe is where all things East meet West come together. And I had a Tantra experience where I was not aware that the man was practicing Tantra with me. And it has been perceived at some level as, and I think in somewhere within my own psyche, as a form of attack, as a rape. And I'm having a lot of trouble getting past victimhood on this, and I wanted to know what you can offer about that.
Okay. Terry, you want to jump in, or you want me to go ahead?
I think maybe this is one's more for you.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Robin. I really appreciate what you're saying,
let me interrupt for a minute. I realize this is a rather heavy conversation, but I'm actually trying to reach out and get help with it, so thank you.
No, that's okay. Thank you for bringing it up, because, you know, this is kind of the underside, and often it's not brought into polite company simply because it's so hard to deal with such intense stuff. But to me, unfortunately, this is one of the great dangers of the presumption of what we might call divine license.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am the one who is awakened. These people coming to me are benighted and suffering, you know, grave illusion and ignorance. And I have to take responsibility to do all kinds of things that under other circumstances wouldn't be socially acceptable to force their awakening to take place. And this is part of what I eventually have quite radically disagreed with as my previous guru Adi Da's teaching methodology.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, for me, to cut right to your point there, I don't think getting over victimhood per se is the first necessary step. Of course, you know, it would take quite a lot of conversation, or at least some, to get more of a sense of where you are in the whole thing.
Okay.
But first, take steps to in effect, get this presence and energetic out of your system if you feel you've been invaded. And that may take accessing some fierceness in yourself and some refusal to put up with, in effect, having been dealt with in such a violative way.
Right. That's exactly how I perceived it. It felt violent. And
yeah.
I was unknowingly almost in this fog for a couple of years, seriously under his control, until it started to lessen up a little bit. And I'm still battling that. So it's been a very difficult situation. Not one a lot of people know anything about. You can't possibly know it until you experience it.
Thank you.
Sure you're familiar with this thing. So
yes, I am, and both Linda and I and other teachers of Waking Down and Mutuality are definitely among those in the world. We're not the only ones, but we're among those who could be perhaps of some help to you. So I encourage you to get in touch with some qualified help.
Okay, great.
Who can help you work it out.
I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you. Good. I appreciate your question. Turning to the Instant Teleseminar questions, there's a really rich one from Fred in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Saniel, have you formulated a Waking Down and Mutuality version of the evolutionary enlightenment model being promulgated by Andrew Cohen? Andrew's framework is rooted in the very big picture of evidence-based cosmic, biological, and cultural evolution. And in my view, his teaching is extremely powerful, but seems to lack balance with the feminine principle. Evolutionary enlightenment teachings really need to be informed by the Waking Down and Mutuality perspective.
Thank you for
in
that.
Are you bridging toward that?
Well, it's interesting that Fred asked this question. Thanks very much, Fred. I just finished a 9-session telecourse with a bunch of folks called A Treasure Map of Your Awakened Life, in which finally, after all these years, I got to lay out my view of our most natural, biospiritual, organismic, divinely human emergence, and one that would encompass all of the chronological stages of life as well as all of the dimensions of our psychophysiological perennial anatomy potential. So in other words, all of the potential yogic and mystical developments, including but also going well beyond stages of integrating our psychological trauma patterns, broken zones, healings, and so on. And in doing so, I cited, if not exactly evidential research per se, I referenced people who are to me the leading theorists of a more organismic and in that sense holistic perspective that naturally would be inclusive of the deep feminine in the ways that we've talked about and that you're alluding to as well. For instance, people like Rupert Sheldrake, Richard David Hames, the philosophy of leadership, who wrote a book, The Five Literacies of Global Leadership. There's all kinds of emerging evidence and recognition that we are now beginning to structure into our work, and we'll be doing a lot more of that over time. So we're on it. We don't have a lot yet that's available, but I do recommend that particular.
Well, is there anything that we can just say right now for folks, though, besides just referring them to something else? I mean, I can say something about how I think your work bridges over toward the evolutionary right here, right now, in a simple way, which is to say that by really just be, that there are two impulses that people seem to arrive at profoundly in their spirituality, and one of them is you might say the inward arc, and the other might be called the outward arc. And it seems to me that you've worked a process of profound interior sensitivity to self and other in your work that ultimately bridges from a place that's primarily about receiving and feeling and allowing and being with what is into an integration that allows one to be more agentic and more assertive and more engaged in an apparently outer leadership, but that it is a different stage in a process that does have a more self-focused dimension initially. And that's how it looks to me. And perhaps you'd want to respond to that. I don't
know. Yeah, well, thank you. Thanks very much. That's very true and well said. And over the course of a lifetime, you know, we talk in our work, we conceive this movement into non-separate, utter unity of consciousness and life. We call it a second birth for biospiritual purposes. So there is there is reference to similarities to what goes on in the original process of conception and gestation and the birth of a human body to begin with. And what we look to then also, along with your description there, Terry, of the inward and the outward arcs, there's also the involutionary process of coming more and more fully into adult life as an awakened being, and therefore you go through stages of divinely human infancy, adolescence, childhood, adolescence, early adulthood, leading eventually to maturity and eldership that would be the time, the phases of life in which most naturally the default disposition and attention of the being is removing from coming down and out into life and, so to speak, going up and out or refining more and more, like I said, a default disposition, not meaning you only have subtle and causal experiences, but that you're transforming in a way that opens you back out and eventually leads to transitioning out of this life altogether. And the whole thing is explicitly an evolutionary process, and that's why, to me, evolutionary theorists, another one is Stuart Kaufman, Reinventing the Sacred, you know, the understanding of evolution as a simultaneously passive and active co-creative event is at the heart of our entire work. So maybe that helps a little bit.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We have a great question here from Wolf in Eugene. I think that a lot of people will be interested to hear about. He'd like to know more about the transmission part of your teaching. What is transmission? Where does it come from?
Thank you. It comes from the living conscious body of someone who has realized this degree of awakened presence in the world. And the paradox is that it isn't merely coming from one body to another, but through encountering one another in a variety of ways, a qualified teacher or adept and a qualified student or aspirant wind up living in a transmission field that's anchored in both of their whole bodily existence. And so in our work, it's in effect what's happening is that the gas is being turned up at the pilot light in the student's heart and soul and whole being simply by virtue of the proximity and then the attention to the work and the relationship that they create with one another. Now, in our context, the transmission, it's remarkably, we could say, aspirant-centric. It's not guru-centric, tending to put attention on the spiritual master or the adept, or doctrine-centric. It doesn't require belief, even in the teaching about it. We encourage people to do due diligence, to find out, to check us out and see if they start to sniff something going on that's starting to activate apparently something in you to accelerate your own growth, healing, awakening, and evolution. So there are a variety of means, including if you go to the website Terry mentioned, heartgazing.com, Linda and I present our version of this traditional method of simply making eye contact that we do live in our workshops and meetings with people. But also, thankfully the internet in our time, photographs and videos can be found to be quite potent. So I hope that answers your question, Wolf, or at least starts to, and I invite you to find out more.
That's great. Well, we're almost at the end of our time, and there are a cluster of questions here about Adi Dasai that I think are kind of interesting, like appreciating that we're, Charles from Toronto has, just really glad to hear our voices on it. DJ in Irvine actually asks for someone new to his teachings, what book would you recommend? Which is, let's see if we can get to that from DJ. But someone who didn't give their name actually asks maybe what might be the meatiest question for you. Do you feel there is any connection between Adi Da's recognition of his own identity as the one and only divine person and the waking down of mutuality stance in regard to ego? Is Adi Da's ego a first try at divinely human being?
Nicely put. Very, very intuitive and perceptive. Yeah, in some ways that is my sense of it, that his sense of his specialness and importance in some ways got quite inflamed. But when I like to say, when you're trying to live God realization for a small planet, we all can't have islands to be unto ourselves. So when we're doing this in mutuality, it's a divinely human, profound individuation that includes the ego sense, but also, we hope, more and more graciously and skillfully lives in mutuality with others and is simultaneously self and other empowering to everybody. So that's a great point.
Mm. Well, what about books to recommend of Adi Da?
Well, Terry, you're more into that than I am. I would recommend, if pressed on the subject, I'd recommend the original version of his book, The Knee of Listening. Let me defer to you on that. You might have a better suggestion.
Well, no, I think that's a pretty good recommendation. I would mention there's a website, bezone.com, BEEZONE, that has an awful lot of Adi Da resources, including many of his audios, and a lot of his radiance comes across especially well there. I have put up a page. If you go to the blog on my website and you go back on the one-year anniversary of his death, I posted an acknowledgement of him, and that links to a page with excerpts from a bunch of his teachings, and that has a link to B-Zone, also a link to a YouTube channel that has a lot of great videos. So I think those are wonderful, easy, quick resources to begin with. But if we're going to go to a book, I would recommend The Knee of Listening 2, I think, the original version. And in that regard, although Adi Da at the end of his life was saying, read my latest Dharma, the old stuff is not as full, I think that actually his earliest stuff is the most accessible. And so I would recommend anything by Franklin Jones, Bubba Freejohn, or Da Freejohn, but not by Da Avabhasa or Da Kalki or Adi Da. Not until, if you get really into it, some of that stuff can be fantastic, but there are a lot of odd conventions of capitalization and hypothetical, hypothecated clauses that make it kind of hard to read. And there's just too much of that Jehovah scriptural odd expression that I think is off-putting to most new readers.
Oh, yeah. Well, by the way, I forgot to say, when you mentioned the Jehovah archetype, the other one that's really pertinent is Zeus,
yeah,
thrower of thunderbolts.
Well, those are the same guy.
Okay, there you go.
It's just
right.
The Greek and the
Greek
biblical.
Yes. That's probably, I suppose, we should mention here. My kind of swan song of service, da-di-da, before I left in summer of 92, in 1990, we brought out, I did manage to complete a serviceable biography of him. It was in that later phase that Terry was talking about, so you're going to encounter some of that capitalization in the quotes and so on. But it's not a bad book, called The Divine Emergence of the World Teacher. I looked back through it again recently and was surprised to find that it was wasn't badly written.
Well, it's interesting looking back on a past life.
Yes.
And our second dysfunctional family of origin, who we
that's
still
right,
love.
That's
we
right.
We still love our second dysfunctional family of origin.
There you go.
Well, brother, it's been really lovely to have this time with you. And I thank you, everybody, for joining us. Before I open up the lines for us to say goodbye and tell you a little more about what's coming up, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for the series. Just go to beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you are intrigued by what Samuel has communicated today, please check out heartgazing.com, heartgazing.com. And if you're also invited to go to integralspiritualpractice.com to sign up for my personal mailing list, my free ebook, The Seeker's Dilemma, and my newsletter. And you'll find some details about my upcoming teaching events, including my two-day workshop in New York City, March 3rd and 4th, and my five-day seminar in British Columbia, Canada, at Hollyhock Farm from June 10th to 15th. And some detail now about what's coming up. As I mentioned, in 2 weeks, February 12th, I'll be talking with physicists and large-scale spiritual activist John Hagelin on Only Higher Consciousness Can Transform Our World. February 26th, I'll be talking with the wonderful Buddhist teacher James Barras, the author of Awakening Joy, a dear friend. In March, I'll be talking with poet and sacred activist Drew Dellinger. And then also the remarkable Austrian spiritual teacher Thomas Hubel, who's been a previous guest, who's a remarkable original voice, and the brilliant Peter Baumann, formerly of Tangerine Dream, and now the author of the remarkable new volume, Ego, the Book. Well, thank you so much for joining Samuel and me today. Let's open up our phone lines and say goodbye. Hello. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, folks. Bye. Thanks very much.
Bye, Daniel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. Bye now.
Thanks for everything.
Bye.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you with us.
Thanks, Terry and Daniel.